And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and a warning about today's show. The title of the book we are talking about includes words that may be offensive to some listeners and inappropriate for children. But let me introduce our special guest today, Susie O'Brien. Susie is a journalist and a columnist with a PhD in education. For the last 19 years, she has written about parenting and social issues for the Adelaide Advertiser and Herald Sun newspapers, and she appears weekly on Channel 7 Sunrise. Susie and her partner together have five kids. They are the Brady Bunch without Alice to hold it all together. And Susie is the author of a new book called The Secret of Half-Assed Parenting, Raising Kids with Half the Guilt and Twice the Joy. Susie, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Thank you so much.
So, Susie, your book feels like it's a whisper in the ear of today's parents. If they're not enjoying parenting, where are they going wrong?
Well, I think we're psyching ourselves out of this. We don't trust our own instincts. We don't trust our gut. We don't trust our own judgments. We're too distracted by worrying about what everyone else is thinking, how they're judging us on social media, what the celebrities might be doing. And people ask me all sorts of questions, you know, should my kids get off the screen? Should I be cooking more food from scratch? Does it matter about organic vegetables? It's like, you actually know the answer to those questions. What you want is me to affirm your decisions. And so I'm here to say, trust your gut. Don't get distracted by what's being posted on social media or the chit-chat at the school gate or the mean girls at mother's group or father's group.
Yeah, look, that sounds a great idea because it probably parenting is different these days than it was even for our parents, say, isn't it, with all the social media input and all the other distractions. It becomes more of walking a fine line as when you're trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, and, you know, I think these days, parenting has become so intense and so hands-on that things that we did in past decades would now be considered neglectful or inappropriate. Whether it's saying no to a child, not just, oh, I'll have a think about it, but no, you don't have to go. No, I'm not going to buy that. Mm. No, you're being naughty, so you don't get it. We take them to, we fill our weekends with activities that kids don't actually see as play. They don't necessarily get enjoyment out of them. Often they're quite stressful because you've got to be on time with the mouth guard and the right socks in the right place. We're losing sight of what it is we became parents for. And there's some research that shows that one-fifth of parents say they were happier before they had kids. And these were people who wanted kids. And another third say they are so time poor and so stressed they don't actually know whether they're happy or not.
Yeah, so maybe it's not a good idea to do a cost-benefit analysis of having children.
And I think the social media has a lot to answer for. I mean, people are often, and they're not doing it to big note themselves or to psych everyone else out, but there's a lot of crap on social media. People, you know, hashtag blessed, when in fact it's hashtag full of crap. They're not actually representing their real lifestyles. And, you know, they're presenting an image of their family to others that doesn't reflect the day-to-day reality. And we know that on an intellectual level, but I think some of us get sucked in, and I include myself, get sucked into thinking that we need to measure up.
Well, the first section of your book is called Becoming Half-Assed. What does that not mean?
Well, it means not being a helicopter parent, not being a hyper parent, and not being a cotton wool parent. So not obsessing about every friendship, not turning up at the school gate and demanding to talk to the teacher every single day, not filling your weekends with kids' activities that don't actually bring anyone pleasure. not leaving a family event just because the kids want to leave. I mean, I was raised in the 70s. I can't imagine my parents ever leaving a social event because my sister and I were ready to go. Whereas these days, parents routinely say, oh, the kids are tired, we'd better go. We slept in so many random people's beds because my parents were still boozing on. I'm not saying that's the standard we should set, but we learned that the world didn't revolve around us. And the more hands-on, hyper-intense parenting we do, the more that is demanded of us and the less that is demanded of them. And I think what we're seeing now is that those kids that we're raising in this hothouse environment, reaching their 20s and discovering they're not the number one superstar, the world doesn't revolve around them, and they're shocked because for once they actually get a reality check.
There is a real risk of giving children a sense of entitlement in those sorts of situations, isn't there? And that just becomes disastrous. And I think you see it particularly with broken families where the child goes to one parent and the parent's so keen to get on with the child that they, you know, the child just has whatever they want, and it's a false world.
Yeah, I mean, we prefer to say blended rather than broken. Broken's okay. We've got a blended family ourselves. So I've got three kids of my own, and we have my partner's kids every second weekend. And I can definitely see how that plays out. I think that not seeing your kids all the time means that when you do see them, you're wanting to for that time to be fun. I think also us working more than ever means that we are... there's a guilt factor that comes, so that when we are parenting, when we do have the kids around on weekends or after work, we're wanting to do more hands-on stuff with them. But I think it's out of whack. I think it's gone too far the other direction, where parents are running themselves ragged, whether it's having the perfect dinner with a fan of rainbow organic vegetables or the lunch boxes, which... you know, the showstopper in the playground with the love note and the face drawn on a banana. You know, these are the sorts of things that are expected of parents these days. And it becomes harder, I think, for people to say, that's not the way I'm going to do it. I'm not going to spend 100 hours making a book week costume from scratch. The kids can make their own school lunches. And, you know, maybe we should just have toasted sandwiches for dinner.
Oh, look, I'm all for it.
The best thing about toasted sandwiches, and that's why I love the fact that there's one on the front of his book, is that kids can make them themselves, and who knows, you might get lucky and they might make one for you.
Wow. Yeah. You mentioned helicopter parenting, and I've never been sure what that means. Does that mean a parent sort of staying off and not getting involved, or does it mean a parent, you know, sort of watching everything that's going on and always being there? What's your understanding?
Yeah, hovering. It's that sense of sort of in the holding pattern. So the helicopter is like hovering over the child the whole time. So I guess just a variant of the cotton wool parent. Or I was talking to Michael Cargreave, who's quite a well-known a psychologist and parenting author, and he was calling it concierge parenting, which again is this idea that parents are there to minister to the needs of every child. And it struck me the other day that it was so annoying that children these days say things like, I'm hungry, I'm thirsty. They don't say, may I please have a glass of water, or could I please have something to eat? Our job as parents, in their minds, is to connect the dots. You know, they're hungry, so we have to work out what to do about that. I'm pretty sure if I'd said to my mum, you know, 30, 40 years ago, I'm hungry, she'd say, I'm Jen, what do you want me to do about it? You know.
Well, yes, I guess at the other extreme, I have to say I identify a little bit with Roseanne, who you quote in your book as saying, if the kids are still alive at the end of the day, I've done my job. And I wonder if there are other parents out there like me who have accidentally nearly killed their kids a few times.
Well, you know what? The standards, well, the more kids you have, the standards just get less and less. You know, when you have the first kid and they drop their dummy, you sterilise it, you've got a spare in your nappy bag. When the second kid drops their dummy, you run it under the hot water. The third kid drops their dummy, you lick it and put it back in their mouth. That's if you notice at all. You know, with my third child, I reckon I only paid attention to him when he was like screaming or bleeding. Anything there wasn't a lot of time, and he's probably the easiest, cruisiest out of the three of them.
We're speaking today with Dr. Susie O'Brien, who is the author of a fun and informative new book called The Secret of Half-Assed Parenting, Raising Kids with Half the Guilt and Twice the Joy. Susie, we've reached a stage of the program where we ask our guests if they'd like to pick a song. So would you like to tell us which one you've gone for?
Yes, I've chosen the Madden Brothers, We Are Done. It was a time in my life when I my marriage of 15, 16 years ended, and the start of a new beginning. And the song maybe had some words that spoke to me at that time in my life.
And that was We Are Done by...
We Are Done.
by the Madden Brothers.
You don't have to dig too far to see where I'm going with that.
And that's, yes, by the Madden Brothers, and it was specially chosen for us today by our guest, Dr. Susie O'Brien, who is the author of a fun new book called The Secret of Half-Assed Parenting. Susie, you refer in your book to the fall off in the level of breastfeeding in Australia, with only 25% now going to 6 months, despite all the clear benefits that are always being identified. Is this part of the problem of parents emphasising the wrong things, do you think?
Well, I think parents these days are sort of a massive guilt and worry, and they don't have confidence in their own bodies and in their own ability to make the right decision. For some women, breastfeeding is difficult, and so they switch to the bottle. Others are worried about doing it in public and being judged by people. The nip slip is something that people always talk about. They're worried about sort of accidentally disrobing in public. And I think that we're not accepting enough of the myriad of ways people want to raise kids. And one of the best ways to do it, so that without too much judgment, is breastfeeding. And really, for as long as you both want to do it. But, you know, there's this sense these days that you have to be slim and that you have to be, you know, out and about. And for women who find breastfeeding difficult, that doesn't always lend itself to that sort of energetic, on-the-go kind of modern motherhood.
Well, it can be a stressful start to the relationship, I suppose. And, I mean, much as I'm, as with my religious background, you know, I'm all for guilt. But really, just feeling just feeling guilty doesn't get you anywhere. Guilt, confession, and penance, and then, you know, you're left with the stress, aren't you?
Well, that's right. And, you know, at the end of the day, people say, oh, should I keep breastfeeding or not? You know, it's up to you. And that's a big message in this book, is that who am I to judge what other people should be doing? And for some people, that is a magical, easy way to start to parenting. And for others, it was absolutely traumatic. And, you know, I think with breastfeeding, there is a sort of subset of women who are really pushing it on people who, for good reason, but still pushing it beyond the point of possibility and thus putting a lot of pressure on women. So I think my message is that we all need to just step back a little bit, take a breath, and stop judging people for whatever decision they make.
Now, the second part of your book is called Milestones, and a big one, of course, is going to school. Should we be concerned if a teacher hugs our child when the child is distressed?
No, I've never really had a problem with that. I mean, I'm a child of the 70s. We were probably hugging the teachers to say hello and calling them by their first names. I mean, I remember my prep teacher in Western Australia was trying to stop smoking, and so every time she'd light up in the classroom, we'd have to yell out, "Miss Malone, put out your cigarette." You know, times definitely have changed, and I think teachers want to be able to comfort a child physically, and they don't want that normal kind of adult-child interaction to be seen as suspect when it's offered by way of comfort to a child who is clearly distressed. And I think when we get to the point where normal interactions are somehow suspect, and I think dads have often copped this more. You know, we had a massive story I remember writing about in the Herald Sun some years ago about a dad in Target or Kmart who was taking photos, like some sort of daggy dad selfie in front of a Darth Vader cutout. And a woman in the store thought that he was taking photos of her or her child, and managed to report him, and someone knocked on his door. The police asked to see the footage in his camera or in his phone because they thought that he was perving on her child. And it became fairly obvious fairly quickly that it was a selfie with a Darth Vader that he had sent to his child. But it was incredibly stressful 48 hours because the woman, of course, took to social media and started posting about this man, and he became fairly readily identifiable. So I think it is really sad when normal things that mums and dads do become suspect.
And at those in those early schooling years, we see a great shortage of male teachers. I mean, would you agree that male teachers shouldn't have the microscope on them all the time either, and perhaps they might even be allowed to hug a distressed child?
I think they should definitely be able to hug a distressed child. If my son, I mean, he's in year six now, but, you know, when he was in prep or grade one or two or something, if that was the right thing to do, we either trust our teachers or we don't. Like, do we trust them to have the professional judgment to make that decision on the spot? I think we have to say yes, we do trust them. And if you don't trust your teachers, then what are the kids doing in that classroom or what are the kids doing at that school? Really, we can't be second-guessing every decision that a teacher makes. They shouldn't be teaching with our kind of eyes over them the whole time. We have to trust their professional judgments or not. My starting point would be, yes, we trust them.
Now, school discipline has changed over the years. I'm very glad that there's no more corporal punishment, but how do you think the teachers should handle, say, a tantrum from one of their students?
Oh, I think teachers are probably much better than parents at dealing with these sorts of things these days. Reward good behaviour always seems to be one of the things, but But also I think teachers should be able to isolate the child if need be and, you know, be very firm in what their instructions are. And I've always found with my kids' teachers, you know, when they're naughty, they do seem to be punished. And I think teachers should be able to punish children, but obviously in an appropriate way.
A lot of parents would agree with you that there perhaps should be some changes in school reports. You know, they seem to... They go to so much trouble to avoid being critical that, you know, it becomes almost a jargon, doesn't it, trying to understand what they're talking about?
Oh, it's almost meaningless. I mean, it's consolidating. What does consolidating actually mean? You know, you want to know, do they know their two times tables? Can they write their own name? You know, they're on a journey of discovery and their learning experiences have been very positive. Well, does he know the six times tables? Can he write in sentences? Has he mastered cursive? Like, these are the things that you want to know. Have they got their pencil grip or their scissor grip? And it always seems to be about belonging and being and becoming and identity. And I think some of the things that parents want to know are a little bit more basic than that.
Well, some people might point to the parent-teacher night, but I've heard that described as just sharing the blame.
Yes, you don't believe what the kid says about me, and I won't believe what the teachers say about the kid. Yes, our parent-teacher nights. I mean, my school, my son's primary school, has just decided that if you want to do it online or in person, why would you do it in person if you didn't have to? That's my view. Oh, look, the parent-teacher interviews. Often I have found, as a half-assed parent, by the time I got there, found the right room, worked out what teacher, you know, my daughter's at high school, so I'd often have eight different teachers, and they'd say, so what's Maddie told you about this topic? Do you tell me about what you think she's been learning? You've got no idea what her third semester geography topics are. Just end up scratching around for something to say.
Now, there is a lot of good news in your book, and one bit that struck me was that you said that bad choices of children peak at age 16. So that means not a good idea to have a 16th birthday party, but you know, you can sort of see the end in sight if that's when these bad choices peak.
Yeah, I've got a daughter who's 15. Some days I feel like we're riding every bump. You know, I say, oh, you can't wear that. You know, those sorts of things. Mm. Why haven't you got any homework? What are you doing tomorrow night? I didn't say you could do that. You know, that real peak teenage time. But my older son's 17, and I can see that, you know, he's just started year 12. And I think he is starting to sort of look beyond himself and be less concerned about what his peers are doing and set his own track. But all the parents say you do not have 16th birthdays, because that does seem to be sort of peak crap behaviour, where you've got, you know, teenagers sort of preloading and then throwing up in the bushes and all that sort of thing. And you really don't, you want to be having, if you've got kids in your house drinking alcohol, you want them to be 18. You don't want to be doing it when they're 15 or 16.
Part three of your book is the bit we've all been waiting for, solutions. Now, one of the things you deal with is where every parent has heard the cry of, I'm bored. How should the parent react when they get hit with that one?
Well, I think find something to do. I'm pretty sure that's what my mother always says. I think these days there is an expectation that if a kid is bored, the parent solves the problem for them, and that we then say, oh, what would you like to do? Where can I take you? You know, what should we do together? Like, that's the proper parent response. But in fact, again, and this goes back to the whole sense of entitlement, kids, it's actually good for kids to be bored. And it's good for kids to find something to do and to amuse themselves without having an array of expensive, tantalising activities put in front of them every 5 minutes.
I suppose, yes, the other extreme is there's a risk of overscheduling, which you talk about. And, you know, maybe we should just let kids be kids.
Yeah, I think the overscheduling is really fascinating. I mean, as my kids even have gotten older, I've noticed from the first, who's now 17, and the third, who's now 11, that the pressure on parents to enrol their kids in all these activities, the idea that more is better, that your family life is really a punishing schedule of jazz ballet and improving activities like a maths tutoring on the weekends or football or soccer, that we that we've lost sight of just letting kids play, letting kids go with a couple of mates to the park on their bikes, which doesn't have to be, they don't have to be driven there, you don't have to pay for it, they don't need the right uniform, they don't need the mouth guard, and it's actually quite liberating when you say, today, you can work out what you want to do, and as long as you check in with me and I know where you are, off you go.
Yeah, I think, as you point out, one stage, that there needs to be some sort of assessment, I guess, as to what the risks are. But you don't want to take away all the freedoms from our kids.
Yeah, and, you know, we were a free, I'm a child of the 70s, we were a generation, you know, conceived in panel vans. You know, we should be the freedom fighters.
Yeah.
We're actually going, turning back the clock. You know, we're scared of everything. And there's all this research that shows that parents are most concerned about strangers, so stranger danger is a big one. The second thing parents are worried about is traffic, which, again, in some areas is quite valid, but, you know, there are footpaths and there are parks. And then parents are scared of other things like magpies and bullies and nits. But, you know, we can manage those fears. I mean, kids aren't generally at risk of random adults doing bad things to them. And in fact, kids need to grow up to see most adults as people who they can turn to if they need a hand. I mean, my son went for a bike ride and I asked him to ring me on his phone when he got halfway. He's 11 and he forgot his phone and he was very worried that he hadn't called me. So he went into a shop and asked the lady if he could use her phone, and I think he gave her 50 cents or something and made the phone call. And that was great because he learnt so much in that one exchange. He learnt the problem solving, the resilience, the talking to a stranger. We don't want our kids growing up thinking the world is a scary, scary place, because it's not.
And look, at the end of your book, you offer a whole series of tips and golden rules, which I would recommend to everybody. It goes through a lot of what we've been talking about and sums it up beautifully. We've run out of time today to keep talking about these things, so I'd just like to give a special thank you to our guest, Dr. Susie O'Brien, who is the author of The Secret of Half-Assed Parenting. Susie, thank you very much for being a guest on Dad's on the Air.
Oh, thank you so much.
And don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you would like to listen to any of our shows, go to your favourite podcast app or our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.